You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It may be a cliche, but it also really is a sign of the season for many people in our region. A grain of hope in the dead of winter when the seed catalogs start to arrive. Dedicated gardeners start laying out their garden plot and circling the seeds they want to buy. But why not go really full circle and preserve your own seeds from one harvest to begin the process of the next? Jim Uhliger is a dedicated gardener in Hinesburg when he's not working as a family physician. But when he was advised many years ago to leave the seed saving to the professionals, he decided to do the opposite and has been pushing the limits of saving seeds. He's written a new book about it. Not a memoir, and not a manual exactly. More of an encouraging guide to inspire other home gardeners to try out what Uhliger says is an incredibly satisfying way to grow your own food. Jim Uhliger's new book is called Beginning Seed Saving for the Home Gardener. It comes out later this month, and he joins us today to see if he can inspire you or just answer any questions you might have about saving seeds. Jim, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise, Jane. Thank you so much for having me.
So is it true that somebody told you to just save the seed saving to the professionals? If you don't have more than 200 plants, don't even bother.
Well, yes, that's true, though. Even before I was told that, it was almost implicit. You know, you would meet people who were such good gardeners and my heroes in the garden world, and they were the first people to say it. You know, gosh, just you want to know that you're getting the right thing. Just buy your seeds. And much to maybe my mother's heartache as an adolescent, I was always the one who asked rules. Like, why not? And so. So after I tried it for a while, I did hear at a more formal presentation about seed saving, like, look, if you really can't do this on a commercial scale, it's not worth doing. And it just broke my heart because it's something I had done so successfully for several years, but something we have done as a human race for millennia. The seed company is a relatively new concept if you look at history from a worldview. So I just knew right then, I was like, you know, I need to make sure more people know about how to save their own seed, even if it's just, you know, one or two things that you grow. It's really fun and rewarding.
So that was the germ of the book. You knew even then you were going to be an evangelist for seed saving?
Well, no, I guess the other seed of the book, so to speak, the germ was, you know, we go to an agricultural fair in Maine every year where we can get all psyched up about our homestead and et cetera. And there was a gentleman, his name is Will Bonzel. He's been a great mentor to me. You know, I refer to him in the book, but Will wasn't there one year. And I remember having a gasp of shock when I saw the schedule and nobody was talking in this very, very large agricultural fair in Maine. It's put on by MOFCA, which was the progenitor for NOFA. You know, like nobody's talking about seed saving. So the next year, as very naively put my own name down, I said, hey, I'll come and talk about it. And Will and I have been partnering on it since.
All right, so sell me on it. I've read the book. I love imagining having the fantasy that not only next year will my garden be in great shape, but then I'll save the seeds and I'll store them and I'll cure them and I'll be ready to plant them the next year. But also, man, it's just so much easier to go to the seed catalog or go to the hardware store and plant something. So why should I save seeds?
Yeah. Well, there's several reasons. I mean, if you've ever grown green beans, I am positive you have not eaten every green bean off that plant. You know, you eat them every other day for a few days and then you forget about them. And so I'm thinking right now about a row of green beans I have at home that are dry and brown on the stalk. And saving those seeds is as simple as, gosh, if it doesn't rain this afternoon, I'll go pick them off the plant, make sure they're dry, and there's my seed for next year. That's actually honestly less work than ordering them.
So And cheaper,
yeah. They're just there. Probably the two most compelling reasons. One is that there are a lot more seeds that you can grow, different types of vegetables, if you don't have to find them commercially available. One of my favorite peas that I grow is a soup pea. It makes excellent hummus. It's fantastic. It's called a capuciner. It's from Holland. And I have not found that pea commercially at all. And it's a very specific kind of capuciner. So I got it from a woman on the Seed Saver Exchange in California. And if we ever lost that seed, I haven't actually seen her list it lately. And so that's the only place I know where to get that seed is from my own garden. Similarly, we had my brother-in-law lost his father a number of years ago, and he produced this wonderful, I call it the brandy wine of the north. It's sweet, it's big, it's juicy, and it ripens early enough for us to have up here. And now he's gone, he's passed. And so I'm the one in the family that keeps that seed. So there's a lot of good reasons to save seed.
And that tomato that you mentioned that was your brother-in-law's father's original seed, you've renamed. You don't actually know what
I have no idea.
What variety is. Yeah. So you call it the Zarovchek?
The Zarovchek tomato, yeah.
Because that was his name?
Yeah, that was their last name. And, you know, for all I know, it could actually be a commercial variety. It came from Russia. It could be a widely available commercial variety in Russia. But I have no other way of getting it than propagating it myself. And I wouldn't – I love growing it, so –
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe get it. You just don't know what it is.
I have no idea.
And it's delicious?
It's absolutely fantastic.
You mentioned the Seed Saver Exchange and that in some cases you can get seeds from this exchange, but this is different than getting them from a seed company online. And I think you say in the book there's something like 8,000 varieties of seeds readily commercially available and more like 14,000 from the Seed Saver Exchange?
Yeah, exactly. So the Seed Saver Exchange is really truly an exchange. So if they have a website, seedsavers.org, I believe, and you can be listed. So there's a catalog. It's paper. It's beautiful paper. I mean, you know, very analog. And they send it to you annually. And that's where – and it's not necessarily just a centrally – located seed company offering their things. It's people offering them from their own gardens. And I've participated several years, not, you know, things get busy. We didn't participate this year, but I got seed requests from Japan. I think that was for the Zarovchek tomato. And that was fun for my kids to see that people, you know, around the world are interested in what kind of seeds each other is growing.
And you're not selling them. It's like you ask for maybe some help with the shipping costs.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
About it.
It's $3 or $4 just to help with the envelope and the mailing cost. I think the person from Japan gave me a $5.
We're talking about saving seeds and how to do it, why you should do it. Jim Uhlinger explains it all in the book. The book is actually laid out not by botanical classification, but by difficulty level. I think the idea is to get people with their, you know, get their feet wet, not get them over their heads too soon. Jeffrey is calling in from Fairfield. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi there. I just had a question mostly about the food drying potential of seeds. I have a large number of beans from my bush beans this year that have grown a little too large to be completely on the plate. And
uh-oh, Jeffrey.
When I tried food dryer for my peppers before, and I'm not sure if my soil test.
Hey, Jeffrey, your phone line is going in and out, but I think what you're asking about is how to dry these beans that you've harvested. And what you told our call screener is that you wanted to know what temp to dry the beans and can you do it in a food dryer?
Yes. Oh, that's a wonderful question. So I suppose you could, but I wouldn't recommend it. So the scenario – and I didn't hear the whole question, of course, but I think I know where he's going because if you have a green bean crop – and we're coming on a frost here eventually in the next few weeks. And those green beans are not going to turn to dry seed that you need on the stalk. Rather than putting them in a food dehydrator, what I would suggest is shortly before the frost, just cutting the stem below, right above the soil line of a few plants and just find a nice airy place to hang them upside down. We do it in our screen porch. They will – and you can do that with dry beans as well if we grow black beans. As long as the bean is black – it will dry down to a recognizable black bean. So drying is very important for storage. But if you dry them down too much, like in a food dehydrator, that can really ruin the viability. They have to be, I believe, around 13%
moisture. Mm-hmm. I think you say in the book, don't desiccate your babies.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well, this will make VPR's Emily Corwin happy. She has a lot of questions about seeds, and as a good investigative reporter, she's listed them all out. And one of them was, can I harvest and save green bean seeds and sweet pea seeds when the pods are still green, or do I have to wait until they've turned brown and dried on the vine for them to work?
Yeah.
So it sounds like she doesn't have – better to wait, but don't have to?
Yeah. So, you know, I this is a very you know, personal approach, but once something's pretty close to being ready in the field, from my standpoint, only bad things can happen to it, right? It can get rained on or eaten by a raccoon. So It is nice when they can dry on the plant, but as long as it has to get big and swollen and full with that seed, and the seed just has to start to be mature enough that it will dry down. So for the dry beans that we all, you know, that many of us grow, as long as it has that rich, deep color that you expect, you can dry it off the vine.
Beans are a good place to start, beans and peas, right? Because
yes.
that's in the easy section of the book.
Absolutely.
Towards the beginning of the book. Why is it easier to do beans than perhaps something else?
Yeah, beans are really easy for a couple reasons. They have a perfect flower. That means the male and female parts are in the same flower. What's more is that they're receptive to their own pollen. So that pollen doesn't even have to transfer from one flower to another. And then the third thing that makes it easy is not only does the pollen not need to transfer, but the petals of pea and bean flowers are very tight around those parts. So by the time that flower is fully opened, there's already and I use very human terms in the book. So if
you are a physician,
yes, I am. But the pregnancy's there, right? It's already happened. So you'll see bees come along and they'll bring pollen to another pea or from another pea or bean to your flower. But it's too late. So it's very easy to maintain purity for peas and beans.
You don't really have to do anything.
Nope.
Because there are other plants, and maybe you can choose which one you want to talk about, where, for example, you might be covering the flower the night before something that will keep it from being pollinated by bees the next morning so that you can hand pollinate it yourself. I mean, that sounds like dedication.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it does sound, and that's why the book that you mentioned is laid out how it is, because sometimes when you look at something like this and you see something like that, and you go, oh, that just seems overwhelming, right? But so that's why if you start like with the very first chapter and you do that for a year, that's how I learned myself. But you're correct. It's squash that really do well with hand pollination. You could also separate them by distance. For most of us in home gardens, that's hard, right? So a really good distance separation is 300 yards, you know, and so it's very difficult. Hand pollination is pretty – it's not as hard as you would imagine.
It actually sounds kind of fun in some ways.
It is. It's interesting. You learn a lot about plants and their reproductive parts. So squash have different types of flowers. There are male and female flowers. So the female flowers are the ones with the miniature version of the pumpkin or squash at the bottom. And the male flowers don't have that. And so the night before, because we don't, at least I don't get up sooner than bees. And if you think you do, haha, right? Even public radio hosts, I'm sure, don't get up sooner than bees.
Parents of very small children might get up before the bees.
Oh, yeah, right. I think we both know that very well. But so you there's a very particular appearance, and there's a picture in the book about what that flower looks like the night before it opens. So you cover that up, and then the next morning – and you should also cover up the male flowers, honestly, too. And then you pull a couple male flowers, ideally from different plants. Squash will receive their own pollen, but they'll do better if they get pollen from a different squash plant. It should be the same type, right? So if you're growing a butternut squash – it should be another butternut squash of that same variety. You can kind of paint the pollen onto that that female flower, then cover it back up. You only have to put that cover on for the next day because after that, the window for fertilization is closed.
We're talking about seed saving, and this is on the more difficult side of it, or at least more involved, perhaps more in your second or third year of seed saving. If you have a question about saving everything from tomatoes to kale to spinach to corn, Jim Uhlinger is here to help and to talk about what he's learned in many years of saving seeds. Again, our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org or post your notes and questions, maybe your photos, on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. So among the easier plants, let's stay with that for a minute. We talked about peas and beans. Anything else that's really easy to save the seeds for?
Yeah, lettuce is easy. The first time we saved lettuce, it was by accident. We planted lettuce and it was wonderful. And we ate little leaves from the sides of the heads all spring. And then we went away for a few weeks and it got hot. And, we came home to 3-foot high lettuce and we just let it go. We didn't even know what was going to happen. But it turns out lettuce, just like peas and beans, has a perfect flower. There's not a lot of crossing. I grow different varieties of lettuce right next to each other all the time. And the hardest or the most challenging thing about lettuce is honestly fall rain or late summer rain. So if you have a seed head of lettuce that's starting to dry down, they look like little dandelion heads. They have the little furry helicopter heads. But if there's going to be a heavy rain and you have one that's starting to dry down, you want to do the same thing that I talked about with the beans, and that's cut the stalk right above the ground and then hang it in a dry place. You have to be careful because the seeds will fall out. They'll be all over the floor. So sometimes I put a shopping bag underneath or something.
What about the other ways of getting your seeds off the plant? You talk about this at the end of the book, hand threshing and winnowing. That sounds like a part that can be both fun. You also say can occasionally run the risk of injury. So you may want to think about how you're doing
injuries,
it.
Yes. For a long time, beans are one of our favorite things to grow. So we would pull the beans off by hand and shell them out. And my wife's grandmother and would sit with our daughter and on a fall evening, shell these out for hours. And finally, one year, I decided I was just going to thresh and winnow them. So you put them on a big tarp when they're all dry, just right on the plant. You don't want any dirt on there because it'll get in the seed. And then you just, the safest thing is a wiffle ball bat. If you want to make a flail, that's can be fun. And you just smash it. And you beat them. Yeah, you beat them. It's good if you're frustrated for the afternoon. And then you either in a wind or sometimes – I actually use a – this is a very homespun thing. I take a shop vac and I turn it around so it's blowing air off. You blow all the chaff away and you're left with very pure beans. And I did that, and great grandma showed up and she was very disappointed that we kind of took her job. She said, "Oh, technology." I thought that was really funny. It's like, this is a very ancient technology.
Like you're putting them through machines.
No. But it is now that we're doing a little more quantity than we used to.
One of the things that I was interested in reading about was what you have to do once you get the seeds. So sometimes it's difficult to get the seeds. Sometimes you're hand pollinating. Sometimes you can let the plant do what the plant does best. But then once you have the seeds, with peas and beans, it's just a matter of drying them out. Some other plants are like that. But with something like tomatoes, you actually need to ferment the seeds. And that's true for other things like, I think, zucchini?
Yeah. Zucchini are interesting. They're more like squash. The principle of zucchini is we eat zucchini flower fruits when they're really babies. So you have to let a zucchini grow up to be a big old winter squash looking thing,
and then not a problem for me.
Yeah, so that's right. Many of us have that experience. For tomatoes and sometimes for cucumbers, people would do
cucumbers.
This too.
That's
it's cucumbers. So you simply smash up the tomato, or you can actually eat the tomato, but you want to pull out the pulp that has the seed, and you don't absolutely have to ferment it. It's just a really good idea because of all the diseases that come along with tomatoes. You can ferment them away. And, a tomato seed looks a little bit like a frog egg. There's a little jelly around it. And so you put them in a mason jar and leave them open on the counter for a few days. And, I always joke, as soon as your partner starts to complain about it, it's ready. I've had a few thrown into the compost pile and inadvertently, I said, no, I was saving those. Like, well, they were moldy. Well, that would mean they're just ready. So when they're moldy, you mix them with some water and pour off the mold, and then you have these beautiful tomato seeds that are ready for next year.
If you're a true Vermonter, don't confuse it for your kombucha mother. It's the tomato seeds, not the kombucha. Let's go to Tammy, who's calling in from Eden. Hi, Tammy.
Hello. Oh, my God, this is so funny. I laugh so hard because your partner is like my partner. Oh, my God, that's hysterical. No, I am calling because I'm drying all kinds of different seeds on my counter of different varieties of flowers because I've been able to have monarch butterflies and larvae and stuff and et cetera. You know what I'm talking about. So do I winter them in my fridge? That is my question.
Oh, that's a great question. So you don't need to. Storage of seed is a really important thing, particularly if you want to make it last for a little bit longer. Some seeds with very marginal conditions will last for years, but some, like onions, will only last for a year or so, and then they'll lose their vigor. There's a few seeds, and I can't think of an example right now, that need to go through a cold spell, right, to be fertile. And I forgive me, I just can't think of one right now. But by and large, seeds store well in a cool, dark place. So in the book I talk about it, we do it in a closet in an unheated guest room, and that seems to work really well for us. The beans last more than 5 years, 6 or 7. So we've had a lot of luck with that. And that's important for two reasons. One is if you have a cross that you didn't want, you can go back a couple years into your little library and get it before you had the unintended cross. The other reason you might want to have a long storage of your seeds is that for certain plants like kale, I use a kale example, where six kale plants once that I accidentally got through the winter because we had a deep snow, I had mason jars and mason jars full of kale seed. How much kale seed can any one person use? And I really wish I had the foresight to put it in the freezer because it can last almost indefinitely. Freezing is a little tricky because it has to be just the right moisture content. And
because you don't want ice crystals.
That's right. Exactly. And then when you take it out, you don't want ice crystals to form because you're opening it. So you could do that one of two ways. You can take it out on the counter and let it warm up, take a few seeds out, then put it back in because you won't get condensation that way. The other thing you could do is actually package 1 year supply in the mason jar. So you're just getting in a something that like a Ziploc bag that mm-hmm. you could pull right out.
So you could have like six years worth in your mason jar, but in individual bags.
That's right.
Okay. So you're sometimes using a freezer. You're sometimes using the dry, cool closet.
Yes.
You kind of built your own root cellar in your basement because a basement doesn't really function as a root cellar, but you can jerry-rig your basement to create a root cellar.
Yes, basements. And this was, I remember this was fun to learn back when I figured it out that a cellar and a basement are different things. I never knew that. But yes, the cellar, many of us have cellars in Vermont. It's the rock walls and the sandy floors, and they're cool and moist typically. A modern basement with a poured concrete foundation is usually cooler than upstairs, but it's pretty dry. That environment's actually really good for storing squash. If it's about 50 degrees and dry, squash, onions store really well like that, to some degree garlic, sweet potatoes. Things like potatoes and carrots need very cold, moist conditions. So even in our root cellar, we actually store them in big plastic totes so they hold the moisture.
Let's go to Rolf, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hey, Rolf, nice to hear from you. Go right ahead.
Hi there. Hey, so we're working on something called the Brattleboro Words Project about Brattleboro's printed word. And as part of that, we found old varieties, heirloom varieties that were being grown in Brattleboro way back in the 1700s. And so we grew marrowfat pea and also Prince Albert, which were both supposedly being grown here. And
that's cool.
The only thing is we grew them at about the same time, and we wonder if we didn't probably hybridize everything. And if so, well, I don't know if what to do about it is exactly the right question, But what we could expect to see, I guess, and if there's any way to separate out those hybrids.
Those are lots of great questions. So the first one principle is, when do you see the cross, right? And so if there were a cross, you would see it in the next year when you grow out the seed. So I, not being familiar with those two varieties, do they look very different? Like, can you tell one from the other just by looking at it in your hand?
Same color pea. Kind of tannish, actually. I was expecting green, but they all dried kind of tan.
Yeah, soup peas dry, you know, they dry tan. And sometimes in storage, they'll get red, even some of them. But were the flowers a different color? Was there some way to tell the difference?
Now, I sadly don't fully have all the questions because they were grown at the local school and they're going to be distributed at the local library. And so that particular plot, I'm not sure how similar the flowers looked because I was growing a separate plot.
Got it. So, well, I mean, the good news is peas do not cross easily, right? So that's, first of all, the very good news. If you did have a cross, I think based on what you're telling me, it might be difficult to tell. But you could go back and if you still have the source of where you got them, you could plant them again. The other thing, you know, one of the big points I make in the book is that we should push the limits of how we save seed. For example, you'll read in places that peas have to be at least 12 yards apart to stay pure. That's not really true. You can really grow them right next to each other, and it's very unlikely to have a cross. The operative word is unlikely. In years and years of growing beans right next to each other, I've had one cross. And I would suggest, though, if you have two varieties that are pretty much irreplaceable, you probably should grow them. You should give them some distance, right? So that's the circumstance where if you have the room, even though I'm somebody who totally pushes, like, wow, just grow them together. That's just what's easy, right? In this circumstance, in future years, I would separate them by – it only takes about 12 yards.
Or maybe if you're growing one at a school and one somewhere else, you can –
Absolutely.
Grow them in different plots.
Yes. If they flower at different times too, that's another thing that can, if you have an early and a late, that's not always reliable though.
And another thing that you do, Jim, is sometimes you'll grow one breed 1 year and then plant the other breed the following year and you'll save a few seeds. But so you're not risking cross-pollination because, or, you know, hybridization because you're not growing them in the same year.
Yes.
But you're still getting the joy of every other year, sort of a new crop of whatever vegetable you're growing.
Yes. No, that was... a Native American corn saver told me that once. I was growing two different types of corn, and they flowered at mostly different times, but I was worried. And you need a big population of corn. Corn's a tricky one. And she just said, well, grow twice as much, but just alternate the years. And I thought, well, that was – should have come up with that myself, right?
While we're talking about hybridization, Nick is calling in from Montgomery. Nick, hi. You're on the air.
Hi there. I hear – I missed a little bit of this, so I don't know how much you've addressed, but I hear you started talking about this subject, but I have saved seeds from various plants and sometimes had problems with the result being quite different than I wanted to. I'm talking specifically about squash family plants, and I wondered, are there ways to avoid it, and are there plants that are good with this and plants that are bad with this?
Yeah, so squash is a great example. The trickiest thing about squash, so there's actually three different species of squash. One is the pepos. Most of the pepos are zucchinis, the yellow crookneck squash that we eat in the summer. And some of the pumpkins are pepos. There's Maxima. That tends to be the jack-o'-lantern pumpkin and like buttercup. And then butternut is machata. We think of a zucchini and a yellow crookneck squash as different things. They see each other as partners in reproduction, whereas a butternut squash and a zucchini do not.
And they don't see each other as the same species at all.
Correct. So you can grow a butternut squash and a zucchini right next to each other. You don't have to do any hand pollination or anything. And they no, you have to think about what your neighbors are growing. And so generally the squash seed that I save the most at home is butternut because it's the only machata that does well in Vermont. I haven't run into another if somebody has one. But so I just don't really worry about hand pollination. I just let them go. And if life gets complex, which it does, I just do what's easy. And that's the easy one, right? So I don't often save zucchini because you really do need to hand pollinate it. And that would be if you're growing more than one pepo or more than one Maxima – and or your neighbors are, and there's less than, say, 200 or 300 yards between them, you need to hand pollinate.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about ways that you, now that you've been doing this for a long time, are sort of pushing your own limits and things that you're experimenting with. And so maybe something like taking the seeds from the plant that blossomed the earliest, you know, so that you can try to select for an early blooming, early harvesting plant. And so that you're doing that sort of selection on your own in your own home garden. Or, you know, cautionary tales like don't plant the leeks that were the spindliest because you want to eat the healthiest ones and then plant the other ones because you're going to end up with spindly leeks. So you've learned a lot about botany. I mean, even as a doctor, having gone through all of this stuff with medical school, you've learned all of this other stuff about being in your garden. And it sounds like for you, that's been one of the joys. It's not just cheap to have your own seeds. It's not just, you know, the actual physical labor. It's this joy of learning and including your family in it that's been so fun.
You really – it changes how you garden if you're open to what happens instead of being really committed to making what you want to happen. So that's definitely been part of the journey.
And any mistakes that you've made that you can help the rest of us not make?
The leek is the most embarrassing one. That's the best one. The one Jane's referring to is that I had some leeks, and some of them were so big, and we ate those, and we had some little ones, and I used those for seed, and you know, the spoiler is that all the babies were tiny.
And you've warned the same thing for onions.
Yes. Yeah. So that's probably my biggest mistake. But the biggest mistake that most people have is they don't try. They just let it become a too of a mysterious thing, and it's not. Just go for it.
Right. It doesn't sound like it's that hard. You've probably saved your own seeds and maybe had a volunteer tomato in your garden in years past.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the community garden I started gardening in was full of volunteer sunflowers. that was the most commonly grown one.
Jim Uhlinger's new book, Beginning Seed Saving for the Home Gardener, will be released on September 24th. Jim, thanks very much for talking seeds with us.
Thank you so much, Jane.